This is Tractor Tuesday Live, hosted by sixth generation Nebraska farmer and Tractor Tuesday founder Zach Bosley and Scott Anderson, owner of New Age Ag Supply. Join them each week as they sit down with farmers, innovators, dealers, and creators who are enhancing the culture within agriculture, right here on Tractor Tuesday Live.
Hey, we're live here from Hastings. It's Tuesday, Tractor Tuesday. And again, make sure you hit the like and subscribe here to our channel. We don't even know when we're going to go live again next. So also sign up for the notifications. And while you're at it, if you're farming or selling equipment, get on TractorTuesday.com. We've got an awesome auction set for February 17th and the 24th. And it's not too late to get your inventory listed. Again, I'm Zach Bosley here with Scott Anderson, New Age Ag Supply. And we're honored and very excited to have our guest today, Greg Peterson, a.k.a. Machinery Pete. Greg, how's it going today?
Hey, doing well, guys. Thanks for the invite to the conversation.
Yeah. And we've got, is it fair to say both Scandinavians here? Am I the only German on the set, or what are we looking like here, guys? Yeah, you might even be related. I guess we'll figure that out as the show goes on. But
Anderson and Petersons, there are a few of us around.
Yeah. Right. So how did everything go with the holidays for you, Greg?
It went real well. My wife Jackie and I were able to get out, visit our daughter, Southern Ohio, with our two-year-old grandson, spent some time there. And it was very good. Low-key, as we get older, home is just a good place to be in general. So we had a little blizzard, an old good old-fashioned Minnesota blizzard there through Christmas. But things are good.
Yeah, awesome. And I guess we can't all be like Scott, who's still in the desert, Palm Springs area, California. When are you heading back to the tundra, Scott?
In about a month.
Okay. Yeah, we both have some babies coming, so I wasn't able to go out and hang out with Scott and the family. But yeah, me and Rachel, we've got our third coming whenever it shows up, so any day now. So I just shared some numbers. Right.
That's awesome.
So yeah, just got to be even older and even older of a dad here. But well, Greg, I wanted to get some of the audience up to speed. We've got quite the spectrum at Tractor Tuesday. You know, we've got a lot of folks, you know, my dad's age. And, you know, I think if I remember right, I'm going off of memory, but when I was with you in Ohio, you said you were going to be 60 on December 1st. Is that right?
Hey, great memory, Zach. Yeah, okay. I turned 60 and I guess can't report any midlife, late life crises so far. So it's all good. I have a little plaque up here sitting off to the side. Our two daughters used to get tired of me and smile when I'd say it, but every day is really a gift and a blessing. So 60s, hey, let's bring it. Let's go.
Well, and so many people are familiar with Machinery Pete, machinerypete.com, what you've done for the industry, you know, and not in a way that is disparaged, but you're really a numbers guy. You know, I mean, you're basically like the end all be all valuation accountant, real nerdy with the numbers. But if we rewind 50 years ago, 10-year-old Greg Peterson, what is that? What's the story? You know, tell everybody that may not be aware of your history, who you are, where you're from, and what 10-year-old Greg was up to.
Well, that's something I'm not asked that often about, Zach. I appreciate how you come at it. 10-year-old Greg Peterson was in Benson, Minnesota. That's where I grew up. My dad and mom settled there in the mid-60s. My dad got into the John Deere dealership business, so I kind of grew up around. That was my entry to the farm equipment world. So at the time, dad had two stores, one in Benson, a little small farming town, west central Minnesota in Swift County, about 3,200 people. And then he used to have a store in Hancock, about 15 miles up the road, and then eventually closed that and built a store in Morris, Minnesota. So I grew up around the machinery and, Benson was a great place to grow up, still a great place. Mom and dad still live there. It's my roots. I try to work Benson into as many references as I can.
Yeah.
We are kind of where we're from. Mm-hmm. And my wife is from Rochester. So we've been living in Rochester, Minnesota for 36 years, but I'm still a Benson boy at heart. So,
okay. Well, good. Good.
My late aunt is from Benson, Kathy Cavanaugh.
I don't know. Kathy Cavanaugh, absolutely. Hey, Scott.
Oh, really?
You get 1 million bonus points for the Benson connection. That's awesome. She had a deal
for donkeys forever. Remember that?
Oh, man. Cavanaugh is a very prominent name around Benson and Swift County. So yeah, that's awesome to connect that way, Scott. I remember a couple of years ago, I was in Watertown, South Dakota. We were filming something for our TV show, and it was a kind of a Pioneer Days type thing. And it was a guy doing a blacksmith demonstration. And I was particularly interested because my great grandfather was a blacksmith in a little town of Tolley, North Dakota, way up, I think, northwest of Williston. And he left the blacksmith shop to become a John Deere dealer in 1920, which was my family's entry into the farm equipment business. But as I was watching this blacksmith demonstration, I got visiting with the guy. I think he was the mayor of it. I think it was, I don't know if it was Edmore, North Dakota, somewhere up in North Dakota, but we talked for quite a while. And then I finally asked him about the anvil sitting right there. I said, "Where'd you get that anvil?" If people follow me on social, they know I like to post auction prices of anvils. And he said, "Well, I actually bought that anvil 25 years ago off an estate sale in Benson, Minnesota." And I just went, "Oh, what?" And he said that the anvil actually had roots to a family that came to farm and homestead in Benson in the 1860s. So here's a chunk of iron or chunk of metal, this anvil that was literally came to Benson 100 years before I was born. And here I am staring at it. So the connection of man and machine and equipment has always been kind of fun for me.
Yeah, that's a great one. Yeah, it's so interesting just to hear some of the origin stories here, and what all you were up to with the family, with the dealership. Were you kind of hands-on as a kid? Could they keep you out at the store, or were you more so just interested in sports at that age?
I was a really quiet kid, really shy. I think my high school classmates still chuckle when we get together. They're like, "How did you wind up going around speaking all the place and doing TV stuff?" But no, I was into sports heavy. I was played basketball and golf. Those were my dad's two favorite sports. So when you're a little kid, you just want to be like your dad. And so on the basketball front, I could shoot pretty good, 6'3", but I only weighed like 160, 165 pounds. So I was our center for our high school basketball team. And so all I had going for me was sharp elbows. I couldn't jump. If you left me open, it was 2 points. There was no 3-point line back then. But I loved basketball, but I've been playing golf since I was 5 years old. Our father played college golf for the Minnesota Gophers in the late 50s for a legendary coach, Les Bolstad, at the time. And so we just wanted to be like dad. So we lived on the edge of the golf course in Benson, Minnesota, which, a lot of small towns, it's hit or miss what you have for a local golf course. But in Benson, we had a fantastic golf course. So we had sort of free rein, and that's where my two younger brothers and I kind of grew up. Just throw the clubs on your over your shoulder and off you go.
And I have a major problem with golf. I'm so bad. And I'm so competitive. It's the one thing I conceded in life is golf. And usually, I mean, we play table tennis. You do anything you want to do. I'm winning. It's just the way it's going to be, Greg. But problem is, I stepped on a golf course, and the first time I ever tried to keep track of my ball. And I think the good thing is, this is after I broke my back, so my expectations were low. But I shot a 137, and I just accepted that, this isn't for me. And I. It's just it's unfortunate. I'd love to get out there. I'm a great guy to maybe chip one in, or make a putt on a scramble type of a deal, but it's such a demanding sport, and it's
Well,
shocking.
it's with your hand-eye coordination playing college football, Zach. I have no doubt. The only thing with golf you need is just some time, and your scores would evaporate. They would drop so quickly. It's a very frustrating game, but that's kind of what I love about it. It's as being a shy kid growing up, one of the things I loved about golf, and I love the teamwork aspect of, basketball in particular, making the right play, the right pass. But golf is all you, and there's no excuses. So when you get done and you've, back in the old days when they had scorecards and you fill that out, that scorecard said everything. And you didn't have to say, it didn't matter. Well, I got a bad bounce. I had this, or that wasn't fair. It didn't matter. It's just, what did you shoot? I like that brutal honesty, which has correlations to, I think on the auction side, when I compile all these prices, you strip out all the emotion and it's just like, what did it sell for? I sort of like the simplicity of, and golf is, it's been just a game of a lifetime. I love that you can be 90 years old and enjoy playing, and you can be 5 years old. And it's been a big part of my life. A lot of fun.
Yeah, no, and it was, and I had no idea, you know, and I've been following you for years, Greg. And then I think you had a post on social media and it was talking about somebody else that may have came from your neck of the woods or had a similar coach that had some success at the PGA level. And then the real big mic drop moment was what you've qualified for. And yeah, if you just want to talk a little bit of how it progressed beyond high school into college and when things really got serious with your golfing story.
Well, Zach, I you pay attention. Nothing gets past you. I appreciate that about you, and thank you for noticing. But this summer, there was a kid from the college I went to, Gustavus Adolphus College, which is St. Peter, Minnesota, little Lutheran school, about 2,300 kids. That's where I met my wife, Jackie. My sister went there, my two brothers, my sister-in-law, or one of our daughters went there. But I played college golf there, and we had a very good Division III program. At the time, we would tangle with some of the Division I schools and do pretty well. Our coach was a guy by the name of Whitey Skoog, which if you ever are in Williams Arena, which is where the University of Minnesota plays basketball since 1917, if you look in the rafters, you're going to see a retired banner jersey for Whitey Skoog.
Okay.
And Whitey was credited, if you can believe it or not, with being one of the inventors of the jump shot. So basketball back in the 30s, 40s was played on the floor. You would just shoot set shots. Well, Whitey was a young kid from up northern Minnesota, and Whitey was a great athlete, and he jumped when he shot. So my dad and my dad's brother looked at Whitey Skoog, and he was like Dr. J. He was a Scandinavian version of Michael Jordan.
There you go.
In the 40s and 50s. He went on to play for the Minneapolis Lakers when they had George Mikan and won, I think, 5 NBA titles. And he wound up going to Gustavus when he retired and was the basketball coach and also the golf coach. So I played for Whitey. My brother played for Whitey. And Whitey didn't really golf, but this was the mid-80s. I was there from 85 to 88. And in the Division III scheme, I think we finished 5th, 3rd, 7th, and like 10th, our team. And myself, I finished as high as I think tied for 5th. So I just enjoyed competing. And when I got out of college, or what you saw this summer was a note. It was a kid from Gustavus right now. His name is Jimmy Abdo.
Okay.
Abdu. And he qualified for the U.S. Amateur, which is, if you don't know competitive golf, they have probably 60 or 80 qualifying sites all over the world, and you maybe get 100 guys, and the two lowest each site advance to the national tournament. And there you take 312 guys, the best amateur golfers. You play for 2 days, and you get down to 64 guys.
Okay.
So in 1992, I qualified for the USAM, and at the time it was at Muirfield Village, which is that's where Jack Nicklaus's the memorial tournament is every year.
Yeah.
I did not play very well at that tournament. I did not qualify for the match play. You play two rounds to get down to the head-to-head matches. And then, amazingly, I qualified again when I was 38 in 2004.
Okay. Wow.
And that the USAM that year was at Wingfoot, which is out of New York, very famous course. And I went out there, and I had two really good first two rounds, and I made it into the match play.
Okay.
And my first match was against an 18-year-old kid from North Carolina. And his name was Webb Simpson. And Webb was the most polite young golfer I've ever run across. And Webb wound up winning the U.S. Open 8 years later at Olympic Club. And Webb has had an amazing career. He's been on Ryder Cup teams. He's won the Tournament of Champions with the famous 17th hole in Jacksonville, Florida. Great guy. So I got past Webb Simpson. And my dad was out caddying for me, retired John Deere dealer. And the second round, I played Ryan Moore, who wound up winning the tournament. Ryan been on the PGA Tour for many years. He played, I believe he played college golf for UNLV. Didn't you play football for UNLV?
Well, that's where I went to undergrad. And yeah, and UNLV had a heck of a golf program, obvious yep. reasons, you know, all the resorts. And they're right. actually probably more known for the female golf team. They get a lot of just solid Canadians down there for whatever reason, probably climate related.
Well, Ryan was, he was a kid from small town Washington State. I think it started with a P. I can't remember the name there, but he was a nice kid. And he was at the top of his game. That summer, he won the USAM, the U.S. Public Links, and the NCAA championship that year. So here I am. I'm 38 years old. I'm playing Ryan Moore. And he was, again, just a very nice young guy. I played as good as I could, and he beat me like a drum.
Really?
He beat me 7-5. He made 7 birdies in 14 holes.
Yeah.
And it was amazing to see. And again, Ryan went on to – he got the winning point at the 2016 Ryder Cup here at Hazeltine. It's been fun for me to follow him all those years. But on the golf side, that was sort of like the pinnacle for me. I had – as I was building our machine repeat business when I got out of college – I mean, the business was so small, I had 2 part-time jobs for 5 years. Okay. And one of them was at the local newspaper in Rochester called the Post Bulletin. And so I'm reporting on high school basketball and football and track and wrestling. And I love that. It helped me as a writer to crank out stories on a 16-year-old kid who, you know, had 2 homers in the Dover Yoda versus St. Charles baseball game.
Okay.
Now, one of the things, the Post Bulletin, they knew that I was a golfer. So they said, hey, Greg, do you want to write a golf column for the paper every week throughout the summer? And I was like, yeah, that'd be awesome. So people in Rochester, Minnesota know me more as a golf writer than the machine repeat guy.
Okay.
Which is kind of funny. But I loved writing about golf. And again, it can seem weird for non-golfers, but I think the life correlations between playing golf and living your life, being a good husband, trying to do well in business, the correlations are there, because in golf, you can hit a really good shot, but it might bounce sideways into a bunker and you make a double bogey.
Mm-hmm.
And as a competitor, you know, I'm curious to get your take, Zach.
Okay.
What you've done. But I figured out, and what my college golf coach, Whitey Skoog, helped me figure out was those bad bounces are going to come.
Yeah.
And the whole trick is just to mentally be able to control yourself enough to analyze kind of the data of this round I'm playing or this tournament, and how well can I handle this? So when I get up to hit my next shot, I'm clear focused on the next shot.
Yeah.
I'm not dragging forward emotion like, oh, well, that wasn't fair. I made a 6 on that hole. I hit 2 good shots. I used to love competing against guys that would get emotional like that, because frankly, I knew I was just going to kick their butt.
Right.
Because if you're dragging emotion, or you're dragging plows around behind you emotionally, you're toast. You're wasting your time. And so Whitey was great about helping us analyze, you know, and then figuring out also, he would ask us after the round. We used to mock him almost amongst ourselves. Like, he would always ask us, what were you thinking about on that shot? And as I got older, I realized what he was really doing was coaching us to identify mistakes and then don't make them again.
Okay.
Identify it. And then the next tournament, when things get tough, okay, let's not go down that road. If you don't identify them, then you're apt to repeat them.
So when you walk up to the tee box, it's your first drive of the day. Let's say maybe you warmed up at the range. Everything's all good. What do you think about as a golfer with probably, you know, a dang near scratch handicap? What's going through your head? Do you sing a song? What do you do to just relax and have a good one off the box?
Well, that's a good question. Back when I was playing my best, which was in my 20s and 30s, I was never a technical golfer. I didn't have any lessons growing up. When I grew up, my brothers and I, there was no range on the course in Benson. We just went out and played. And we took little tips from our dad, who was a good player. But, I mean, there wasn't like YouTube on cell phone with people slow motion analyzing your swings. And that's how all the good young players now, they have all this feedback. That's how they learn the game.
Right.
That ain't how I learned it.
Okay.
And so for me, when I went out to play, I just wanted to have a clear head and just go compete. And so I didn't get hung up on the fact that I pushed the first 3 shots or I pulled a couple. I didn't drag that with me. I would adjust to what my body was doing that day. My hands are a little slow today, so I better close the club face, or I'm too quick. I better open the face. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of how I played. It was kind of an intuitive way.
Okay.
Now, to complete the story and be completely honest here, what I would have to say is that after I made that USAM in 2004, I was 38 years old. And at the time, our two daughters were 13 and 11. And that was right about the time, to be honest, Zach, I started to like, holy cow, our two girls are going to college here in a few years. College is expensive. How is this all going to work?
Right.
And so my headspace had been, up to that point, had been building the business. But number one was I was trying to be the best dad I could be.
Okay.
Because, I mean, that's job number one, be a good father and husband, because your girls, they're just going to snap your fingers and they're 30, 35 and 33 like they are now. So I knew that was job number one. And then when I got to be about 40, it was like, boy, it's time for me now to really lean into this business that I've been building. Mm-hmm. And I did that. And when I did that, my golf game went south.
Okay.
So being a field player, non-technical, plus getting older into my 40s and 50s, mm-hmm. I went from going to the first tee expecting to shoot 70 mm-hmm. to going on to the first tee being scared.
Yeah. Well,
I didn't know where the ball was going.
Okay.
And so as a golf writer, I do hope to write a book here in the next few years about this journey, this challenge of, you know, having a high expectation and then all of a sudden, seemingly I didn't do anything, but all of a sudden the results are the opposite. What happened?
Yeah, right, right.
And the easy thing to do would have been to quit and say, well, I don't quit. So I still enjoy the process. My results in tournaments have been very poor for 20 years now. But as I've got older, I've started to realize we hopefully learn truths about ourselves as we age.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things I've realized is that I'm kind of a one-track guy.
Okay.
So what I focus on, that's going to be good. I'm going to have fun doing it. And it's, you know, I mean, I don't mean to sound non-Norwegian here, but like you said, you expect it to go well and it, by God darn, it's going to go well.
Okay.
And so that the last 20 years had to be business and I've had so much fun building that. And now that I turned 60, I'm attempting to find that lost golfer part of me that I know is in there somewhere, but I want to reintroduce him to this old version of me, these things I've learned and say, hey, I think we can get along. Okay. Let's just have some fun and go try it. So my biggest challenge the last few years playing golf, when I step on the first tee, has been to clear my mind.
Okay.
Cause I'm thinking about the 5 social posts I got to do and those 2 auctions and these prices are coming in. And I just talked to this dealer and it's all wonderful. Love it.
Yeah.
But, it's almost like a digital cleanse. I have to I leave my phone in my truck and I just try to have the mindset, let's go out and play. And it ain't going to be perfect, but that's the fun of it. And let's just enjoy the process. And the greatest thing I love about golf, guys, is just we live in an increasingly impersonal world.
Mm-hmm.
But when I go play golf with my buddies here in Rochester, it's so fun to go, hey, Scott, how you doing, man? You have a good week? How are the kids doing? And then that you have 3 hours or 3-4 hours when you're playing 18 holes to talk to people and to listen.
Yeah.
That I really, really enjoy that part about golf. So it's been a winding journey, but I'm excited for what's to come.
And I'm extremely ignorant, Greg, because at what age are you eligible to go from the senior tee boxes?
Well, senior golf tournament cycle at the national scale is 50.
Oh, really? Wow.
Interesting side story there. That's all due to Arnold Palmer. Mm. Because when Arnold turned 50, I believe it was 1980 or 81.
Okay.
The USGA, which is the United States Golf Association, changed that you had to be 55 before that.
Okay.
They so wanted and needed Arnold Palmer to be in the U.S. Senior Open. They changed the rules for Arnold.
Okay.
Well, by the way, Arnold Palmer was the speaker when I was at the USAM at Wingfoot in 2004. We had dinner the night before, and Arnold Palmer came in to talk. And it was so interesting. I was sitting next to Tom Lehman's brother from Minnesota, very good golfer, Jim Lehman. And Arnold, we were sort of hoping he would tell war stories about, you know, winning the Masters and the US Open and stuff. But what he talked about that night was decorum.
Okay.
And Arnold Palmer got up and went on a tirade about guys not taking their hats off when they come inside to a restaurant. And how disrespectful that was.
Yeah.
Now, Arnold was, you know, an older guy at the time, but, you know, we had to certainly enjoyed his perspective on things. But so basically at the state level here in Minnesota, it's 55.
Okay.
And I just turned 60. So the last 5 years, I was hopeful when I turned 55, my golf game would magically come back. But to this point, I'm a 4 handicap now.
Okay.
And I hate that. I do not like any part about that. I want to be what I used to be, but you know, it is what it is. I can either quit or I can enjoy the struggle to grind that game back down again.
So now with your era, do guys still wear the glove when they putt, or do you take it off like young kids, or what's the fashion move?
Well, when I was a kid, Jack Nicklaus kept it on.
Right.
A lot of, and my dad kept it on when he putted. Okay. So we wanted to be like dad, but most guys take the glove off. I'm trying not to be a cranky old guy here, but some things about modern golf I don't like. One is the clothes, the fashion.
Okay.
I don't like tight fitting clothes.
Okay.
The Euro cut, I hate
right,
it.
Right.
That's why I wear a hoodie every day.
It's just, okay.
You know, if you go back to watch golf when Tiger Woods was young, it was all baggy Ashworth mm-hmm. shirts.
Yeah.
And the pants were pleated pants and stuff. But I'm so old, I go back to the Sansevieria stage of the nice tight 1980s. It's funny, if my daughters ever see a picture of young Greg on the golf course, they're like, oh my God, oh, what are you wearing?
You need to forward us some of those images. We'll put that for the preview yeah. on this. It'd be awesome. Confuse everybody a little bit more. But, you know, and really my take on all this, I am so bad. I've had 5 birdies my whole life, and my wife and me were at Red Sky Ranch, beautiful place to go in Colorado. And actually the first time we went there, we were paired, and I feel terrible. I can't remember the gentleman's name, but a Hall of Fame wrestler from University of Minnesota, mm-hmm. cauliflower ear, the whole thing. I could tell he was a wrestler by the way he was moving. Some big consignment import export guy. I feel bad. He's probably not watching, probably doesn't remember me. But, you know, back to your point, it is really enjoyable because, yeah, you just randomly get paired with these interesting people from all over the world every time we've ever gone out to the Rockies to golf. And it makes me feel a little bit better. I'm so fused up. You know, I could probably do better with my hybrid than I do my driver most days off the box. But, yeah.
Well, just hit the hybrid off the tee, Zach. As I get older, I think the number one rule and truth with golf is it really doesn't matter what you shoot. Yeah. As long as you have fun.
Right.
And what it's been fascinating. The game of golf was dying on the vine after probably in the 2010 on. It just, you know, our world was our cell phones.
Yeah. Right.
That didn't fit with going to spend, you know, 2 to 5 hours on a golf course without your phone. It just didn't fit. But ironically, the pandemic changed everything.
It did.
When people were so cooped up, and I live in Minnesota here, and we were forcibly cooped up almost more than any place.
Yeah.
But importantly, Minnesota is the number one per capita golf state. Mm. And so even though at the time our government here in Minnesota was very restrictive, they did allow you to play golf. They advised you to keep the pin in when you putted so that not everyone would pick up the pin, get germs or whatever. But the game of golf just exploded here.
Yeah.
And because people wanted to get out and feel human again and talk to people and play with your buddies for 3-4 hours, have a couple beers, whatever.
Right.
And that's stuck since then. 5 years ago, we were wondering whether young people would stay with it, but I think they figured out, you know, this is a crazy game, but it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
And it's the fun of being with my buddies and my friends. And again, it doesn't matter if you shoot 186, just go have fun and enjoy being outside and, you get some good exercise and, it's fascinating. But again, as a writer, I would weave in a lot of these different angles. And, I wrote a golf column one time here in Rochester. I think I wrote for about 12 years, but I wrote a whole column about that moment when you hit a shot So it doesn't matter if it's an 8-iron or driver or whatever. Okay, whoosh, you hit it. You're in your follow-through, and you watch it take off. Now, you've done your part. You did everything you could control. That ball's on its way.
Mm-hmm.
And you hit a really good one.
Okay.
And the feeling that you get in here, in your eye, in your head, in your hands, the sensation, very positive. Now, what you can't control is what happens when that ball comes down.
Right. Yeah.
And the whole point of my column was that moment, I call it a moment and a half before you know the result. It's like anything's possible. That 8-iron you hit, that might go right in the hole. That might be the hole in one you've been waiting for your whole life. Now, it might be a perfect shot and plug in the front bunker. You might make a triple. But that's the fun of it, is those moments in every round where you hit a shot just right. And then as it's coming down, what's going to happen? That to me is the allure of the game right there.
Well, and for me, it's just like basketball or anything else I've ever been a part of. It's just, I play better with better people, you know, and I get paired with better people when I go on these little adventures. And I mean, I'm lucky to get one full round in a year. And it's really, my back kind of gives out about hole 12 or 13. But, you know, my first three birdies were all chip in. I never had putted one in for a birdie. And honestly, my very first birdie probably shouldn't count. I was out of bounds by about, you know, 4 inches or so. But, you know, I chipped it in from about 60 yards. And that's the problem with golf. It's so addictive. You do something like that and you're like, oh, man, I'm good at this. Okay, I'll stick around a little bit more. But the problem is I can't ever clear my brain, because in the back of my head, my grandpa Lyman is saying to me, never trust a farmer that's too good at golf. And it's like a mantra in my head. And I repeat it all the time, because, you know, in my neck of the woods, we're irrigating, we're farming, and we're doing things. And, you know, I make fun of my Iowa buddies that just mow ditches all summer. So it's one of those things I've got to deal with and accept that I can afford to play the game now, but it's hard not to be biased. I mean, I'm in such a golf community. It's unreal. We're a town of 25,000 people and we've got three completely unique separate golf courses. I mean,
Nebraska,
it's nuts.
I'm sitting here, I'm looking kitty corner right in my little office here in the basement of our house, a picture of the 18th green from Sandhills.
Yeah.
Out in west in the Sandhills of Nebraska. Mm-hmm. My dad and brothers and I went out there in 2010, and one of the world's greatest golf courses.
Yeah.
In the middle of nowhere in Sandhills of Nebraska. So I think with golf, again, the trick is really, you know, expectations, which are really how you become a really good player, is like you said, Zach, that's what my brothers and I helped each other growing up, playing, competing against each other. You want to beat your brother, you want to beat your dad, but it's all good. It's like sharpening iron. You just sharpen each other. Yeah. And, but then again, you can have just as much fun by having a regular group, or I like just going out and playing with new people.
Okay.
Because, you know, God gave us two ears and one mouth. So where are you from? And, I just love that piece about golf. It's social.
Yeah, it is.
Which always has kind of reminded me of the auctions, honestly, because when you go to the auction, you maybe went for that cornhead, but really the biggest value you're going to get from that time spent there is the conversations you have with people. And I was talking to Zach, and Zach told me something that made me think. So I've always really enjoyed that piece about golf. And one thing, it's not just Minnesota here, but as we were competing, and I still compete in amateur tournaments and stuff, one of the cool parts is you do pull for your competitors.
Yeah.
You want them to do well. Like, you want to win, but you want to beat them at their best.
Yeah.
And so golf in our world today, which is, you know, seemingly our standards continue to crumble, and we take shots at each other and all that. It's just, that's not golf.
Yeah.
Golf is do your best, but, you know, police yourself and pull for your opponent. And it's a game of honor. And it's for young people who learn to play the game. And again, because you get these emotions, like, you want to do well, and it's hard when you're 10 years old and all of a sudden I remember playing in this, I qualified for the state tournament when I was in ninth grade. I'm 15 years old. And I start off par, par, par. And I'm thinking, oh man, this is great. And then I triple bogey the next hole.
Yeah.
And I literally got tears coming down my face. I blew it. You know, but that's all part of it. You have to learn how to manage the good and the bad and the sideways.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's really two kinds of golf. There's golf for fun, which is awesome.
Yeah.
If you do drift into the competition part about golf, that's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
And that's played up here and in here in your heart, not yeah. so much the swing and all the putting. And it's just, you've just got to find a way with your swing to get it done and make it happen. And I love that piece of it.
No, it is a cool sport, and it's interesting. My wife and me both got into it about the same time. I had my back done in 2018. That's when she started golfing, I think, just to get out of the house and, you know, quit getting barked orders at while I'm in bed for a couple of months. But, you know, she was a great athlete, played basketball in college, and immediately, the very first year, she got into the competition side of it.
Ooh,
you know, and just okay. would do the city open and fight through. She's the type of gal, she'll literally go 300 off the tee box.
Wow.
But, you know, you better have your head on a swivel. She might kill you. You know, it might be in, you know, two fairways away by the time it lands. But she's been able to harness that. And it's fun to see the competitive side of the golf thing. And now she's progressed, gotten better for being new to the game. And I think I started in 2020, right around that whole COVID era. But, I mean, my town is just so unique. These guys are getting off work out of the factory and have a clean change of clothes. They go to the golf course. You know, and it's or you got the country club guys that are,
yep.
you know, getting out of their Mercedes and not scuffing their nice loafers. And then they're changing and they go into the country club. And it's right here in blue collar Nebraska. So
the thing I love about it, and golf does play to all parts of our culture and economy. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you've got the kind of the hoity toity end of it, which is fine, whatever.
Yeah.
But I grew up playing in our little town of 3,200 people. Green fees were, I don't know, were $8-$10 or something, and you just play. And one truth I love about it is that little white ball
mm-hmm.
does not know or care who you are.
Yeah.
So you could be a billionaire
mm-hmm.
with the nicest clubs, the fanciest clothes. You came up in the Mercedes, you put your tee in the ground, that ball don't care.
It
just
yeah.
doesn't. Golf is just, you know, or you could be, I've run across guys in tournaments one year. I had my heart broken at a tournament in my hometown of Benson one year,
okay,
like 1985. It was a 27-hole tournament. We used to call them shortstops. You get about 50 guys come in, good players come in, and we play 27 holes. You play 18 and then 9 more.
Mm-hmm.
So I was standing on the 26th hole on the tee box, and I was in the lead, and the guy chasing me was up in front, and he was an old Dutch potato chip salesman. Drove a truck, and his golf yeah. shirt did not cover his belly button. His gut hung out.
Nice.
And he didn't wear golf shoes. He wore tennis shoes
mm.
and he wore big sunglasses.
Okay.
He looked nothing like, you know, what you see on TV. But again, that little ball doesn't give a crap.
Right.
And Judd, his name was Judd. Judd could play.
Okay.
And I watched him on this hole. He blasted a shot. He was dead. He was way over the green in the long grass on a downhill. He had no shot.
Okay.
And he took out his 7-iron and he hit the most incredible little shot through the grass up this hill, down, and then stopped right by the hole. He made the putt. Mm. He made by one shot.
Wow.
And Judd was the greatest guy. But I love that you would look at Judd and you would say, I'll kick his butt.
Yeah.
But that little golf ball doesn't care.
And yeah.
Judd won. So that's the beauty of it.
Well, and when I first met you, I had no idea, you know, and I didn't even know what to expect. I'm used to people being shorter than me. I'm used to people, you know, and especially in the ag industry, just, yeah, they're probably not into these types of things. And it was so cool to hear more of your story, you know, just as I really started following you even closer. And I guess, and I've known Scott for about a year and a half. We've had a lot of back and forth. We've met in person in Hastings here. Scott's running all his cows down in Nebraska to get them out of the cold weather. But I guess I never even asked you, Scott, are you into golf or what are you doing out in Palm Springs all winter?
Yeah, I play golf here and there. And
yeah.
for the main reason that Greg was talking about, the social aspect of things, you know,
okay.
just the conversation you get with, you know, I usually play with like a mentor of mine or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can just kind of, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours of non-scripted, just visiting and catching up.
I'm telling you, Scott, the way you answered my question though, makes me feel like you're really good. I don't know. I mean, I know how Scott's mannerisms I'm still
measuring by how many golf balls I didn't lose.
Okay, so good.
If I lose less than a box, I'm having a pretty good day on the golf
course. Okay, good. We'll have to give you some of those wholesale Tractor Tuesday golf balls.
Hey, I have an idea here, guys. Maybe you two guys can help me with it. And frankly, I'm kind of amazed this idea has never occurred to me before. But like we're talking about, I've been playing golf my whole life and now building the Machine Repeat brand and our whole thing all these years.
Yeah.
What I really need to start is an annual Machine Repeat Open.
Yeah, you do.
Where we just invite the farm audience. Like, let's go to Des Moines, let's go to Champaign, Illinois, come up to the Twin Cities, Rochester, wherever, Hastings, Nebraska, we'll come out your way.
Yeah.
Make it the Tractor Tuesday Machine Repeat Open. And we bring people in and we raise money for, like, my friends at Farm Rescue, Terry Johnson, great guy, running the company there, helping folks in ag in need. But for ag folks who do love to play golf, like, let's get together once a year. Just like Scott was saying, it's so fun just to.
You're one step ahead of me, and I guess maybe two steps behind what we've already been discussing internally, Greg. And here we got a comment on YouTube from Golfing Farmer, of all people. This guy's always commenting on stuff, but thanks for tuning in, Golfing Farmer. He says, your golfing career is truly impressive. You've played some magnificent courses. He followed it up. He's ready to sign up for the Machine Repeat Open here, apparently. But so this is what we've been talking about, is our great now nonprofit evolved from the NIL space, from farm athletes, into now being its own 501c3. What we ought to do is a co-branded thing where it's the Machine Repeat Golf Tournament, and it could benefit anything, farm rescue, farm athletes, because there's so many great student athletes that are into sports. And I think what's interesting is, you know, with NIL and everything going on at the big Division I type universities, there's more farm kids than ever that are basically settling, if you will, for smaller schools that could use a little bit of assistance. And had somebody else give you a shout out. Somebody, Gary Roberts, says hi. So we're getting a few folks paying attention here at least today, but, no, I think we really ought to do it. And we've got some beautiful golf courses, obviously, in Nebraska. I've got some really cool friends that, it's funny, most of my buddies that were in the NFL or other things in baseball, that's their default. They just go right into golf because it is such a competitive thing. And I think their minds are just wired that way. So
yeah, it's the competitive angle. As a competitor, as a kid growing up and like yourself playing college football, Zach, I mean, it's, if you can find an outlet to channel the competitive gene, that's, golf can really fit the bill there. I have a lot of friends I play with here in Minnesota. One in particular up on the Wisconsin, Minnesota side, he didn't start till he was 23.
Yeah.
Played college basketball. He was a shooting guard, I think, for River Falls. I think shout out to them. They just won the D3 football.
Nice.
But I mean, if you compete, and again, golf itself is littered with stories. There's a guy named Larry Nelson who won the U.S. Open and two PGAs. He got three majors. I think he's in the Golf Hall of Fame. He didn't start playing until he got back from Vietnam. He's 21 years old. Because again, that little ball, it doesn't care.
Yeah.
And so golf is an amazing game that way. And I do know there's a lot of farm folks, a lot like my little town of Benson where I grew up, the golf course is really a vital piece of your community. Whether it's community owned, like it is in Benson, or private, whatever, you were proud of where you're from, Hastings, Nebraska, Benson, Minnesota, Scott, you said South Dakota, what was the hometown again?
By Everett.
Okay. There you go. But if your town has a nice little golf course, that means something. That's a big thing.
Yeah.
So it's a great asset for the community. I think I would like to explore the idea of just getting together people who love to play golf and try to raise some money for great causes. And I love what you're doing, Zach, with NIL. And it's funny, I'm a Minnesota boy. I love the Minnesota Gophers. As I sit here in my Penn State.
Yeah, I was wondering. Yeah, where'd that come from?
Our oldest daughter lived in State College for 7 years, taught math at the high school there. Her husband was going through the getting his PhD in history. Mm. He's a history professor. So they live in Los Angeles. They're moving to Wyoming.
Oh, wow. Got
another daughter in Southern Ohio. So there's lots of golf courses for me yet to explore in all these places.
I'm surprised a lot of your travel schedule, because for folks that don't know, I mean, Greg basically lives in an airport. I mean, is that fair to say, or do you live in your truck? How does it break down?
Well, I prefer to drive. I much prefer to drive. Just the way air travel has got with connect. I don't like connecting flights. Mm-hmm. Like you said at the top, Zach, I'm a data guy, and I don't like the data around connecting flights.
Right.
Not good data. Mm-hmm. But I don't mind flying. I love. In fact, tomorrow I'm heading down to Arkansas. We're filming an auction down there. But travel a lot. Not as much as people think.
Okay.
People assume I'm on the road every day. I'm actually sitting in my basement like I am today mostly.
Okay.
We work with 1,400 auction companies, and we try and get them so they report to us.
Right.
Maybe send us video clips. And then it seems like Machinery Pete was in Kentucky, but I was sitting here watching our two dogs while, you know, the auction was taking place. I could comment on the auction.
Oh, for sure.
But it's travel is, again, the fun is it's the same as golf. It's the people that you meet along the way. And I do find it interesting being a Norwegian boy from Minnesota here. And Minnesota nice is a real thing. I mean, it's not just a saying. But when I go down south, when I get to Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, North Carolina, Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, Florida, Texas, it's different down there. Mm-hmm. I love going south for the people.
Yeah.
It almost feels like they just, we've been buddies for years. And
we're
a little more arm's lengthy here in Minnesota. We're kind of stoic.
Yeah.
But I go down south and it's just a, I can't really describe it other than to say I just enjoy the people down there so much that I can't wait for my next visit.
I'm just surprised you don't travel with a golf bag, you know, when you do hit the road, because I think maybe there is a little bit more truth to that you're not admitting, but it seems like.
Well, no, actually, I haven't. Two things. I've never bought a piece of equipment at auction in my 36 years. People can't believe that. I've never bid on anything. And I don't tend to travel with my clubs at all.
Okay.
Because again, as I get older, I'm a one track pony.
Okay.
So when I'm on a road, I'm there to do my thing. And I want to give all my time and focus to the people there. And so, I don't want to be in my head thinking I got to bounce cause I got a tea time at 3 o'clock.
Right.
I want to give myself to the folks there. Now if I tilt this way, you can maybe see behind me there.
Yeah.
That's a picture of Muirfield in Scotland.
Okay.
Which I played that. I played the 2005 British Amateur on that golf course.
Mm.
And I am traveling with some buddies this summer. We're going back to Scotland for a week-long golf trip. That'll be very fun. I'm looking forward to that.
Nice.
And the funny thing there, I think when I go to Nebraska out in the sand hills, it's the same thing. It's you look at soil as it relates to ag and as it relates to golf. Now, I'm from Minnesota here. We got a lot of good black dirt, which awesome. You know, we can grow, feed the world. But strictly from a true golf lover's point of view, what you want is a sand-based soil.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it can, you know, and when you go to Scotland or Ireland, it's pure sand. Or here in the sand hills, literally the sand hills in Nebraska.
Right.
You can make the world's greatest golf courses on that turf.
Mm-hmm.
And when I come home from golfing in those conditions and I come back to our black dirt, I get sad.
Okay.
Because that's the way the game started over there in Scotland. They figured it out. And that's really the way golf should be played because the ball bounces. So I'm a numbers guy, mathematical. What I love about that is you'd be 150 yards away, which here in the Midwest with black dirt, I know, well, if I hit my 9-iron, it's going to go 150 yards and go splat and stop.
Yeah.
If I'm in Scotland and I'm 150 yards away, but the wind is behind me, if I hit my 9-iron, it's going to land and bounce over a building and keep going another 100 yards. So I have to figure out the math of that to make my ball bounce enough to wind up 150 yards. And I love that math of trying to figure that out. But to have that kick in, you need hard, firm ground, which is not black dirt. You need sand-based.
Yeah.
So that's why if for the golfers out there watching, you see these resorts popping up like in Oregon, in Bandon Dunes, or in Wisconsin, Sand Valley. They're building their fifth course. I've been there quite often. The reason they build there is because those investors they scour the country to look for like what you have in the sand hills of Nebraska, where you can drill down and it's 10 feet of sand.
Yeah.
Wherever you find that, you can make world-class golf. If you get away from that, it's
ridiculous down here. I mean, I think at any given time you could take the top 50 US courses and we've got a half a dozen, mm-hmm. you know, and then
absolutely.
Even over by Omaha and off the rivers, you know, over that way, there's some phenomenal courses throughout the whole state. It's kind of shocking that it's such a thing now, but so when's your big week? What month is that trip?
That's in June. Okay. I'll still be working when I'm over there, keeping up tabs on stuff, but, I'll be enjoying my golf brain 7-8 days on the sandy soil of Scotland.
And okay.
As fun as the golf is over there, the more fun is to finish your round. And golf over there, it's different than here. Mm-hmm. Like you described in Hastings, you've got 3 or 4 courses there, and they all mm-hmm. kind of have their own level.
Yeah.
When you go to Scotland, everyone's on the same level. You could literally okay. be a billionaire mm-hmm. or the poorest guy and gal in town.
Yeah.
But if you love golf, you're equal. You're absolutely okay. equal. Hmm. So you play your round, you'll go in to have your pint of Guinness or whatever. And it doesn't matter who you are. They all yeah. golf is in their soul
okay.
and their DNA.
Yeah.
So being around people that think that way and live that way for a golfer is kind of heaven. So
yeah.
It's a lot like hunting.
Yes.
Hunting. Yeah, there you go.
Yes.
Well, yeah. I was fishing there for you, Greg, because we were talking about with this Farm Athletes tournament was doing something in June because July down here gets pretty muggy. It's pretty it can be a real nightmare. So maybe keep that in the back of your mind. Let's try to pin a Saturday on the calendar. We've got some really good friends at Tractor Tuesday that own a golf course here in Hastings. It's not my country club, but I'm just there to maybe get supper once a month or something and make my minimum. But my wife gets all the use out of our membership, so it's not really me. I've got the opposite situation. Usually it's everybody looking for an excuse to tell their wives they can go golf. With me, it's the opposite. My wife's trying to find babysitters so she can go golf. And, so all my guy friends are jealous of my dynamic, they think.
Okay, I will just one little machine repeat life tip, take it or don't take it, Zach. But okay. I have to. So how many kids do you have now?
Just currently 2. Yep.
2. And will this be 3 or?
Yep. Number 3 is on en route. So any day now.
Okay. So I'm a math guy and I can't tell you how fast those years will fly by. And if you have a wife who loves to play golf,
mm-hmm.
even though it can be really frustrating for you now, if you think about the potential amount of raw time you could spend with your 3 kids and your wife together, the 4 of you, 5 of you on mm-hmm. the golf course. That's how I grew up with my 2 brothers and my dad. We 3 times a week, we'd go play 18 holes.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Now I'm 60, my dad's 88, my brothers are younger, but that will always be a piece of us, all that raw time we spent together just playing. You know, we're trying to shoot low, but the togetherness is something that golf offers that really nothing else. I mean, hunting, fishing.
Yeah.
But if your wife loves golf, you're actually sitting on an opportunity there to have incredible time with your kids.
I know you're right. And there's a lot of good truth there. The sad thing is everybody wants to be like their dad, but my kids are not going to want to be like their horrible golfing dad. So I might lose some dad points. We've got cool pictures of me doing other things, but if that's the memory they remember.
Oh, so you get, you're giving up too easy. If you play D1 college football, I'm just guaranteeing you, even with your fuse back, if you just had a few rounds to devote to golf, your scores would drop astronomically. And particularly watching your wife hit it 300 yards, your scores would just evaporate. So not trying to be an old guy and tell you what to do, but
That's what I've been telling everybody here locally. I'm setting myself up to be the best senior golfer in Hastings. I've got a really good friend. He was best man at my wedding, big dude like us, 6'5", 6'6". And he self-taught himself how to play golf in his early 20s. The Big City Open, it was some sort of qualifying event at our course for something with this amateur stuff. Again, it's a different language. It's like talking about extend flex beams to some kid from California. But it's just, you know, so all these kids from the University of Nebraska, Omaha, Lincoln, Creighton, all brought their number 1 or number 2 golfers to the City Open in Hastings. And yep. Here's my buddy, Mike Sabata, self-taught golf guy, literally. And I, sorry, Mike, but cigarette hanging from his mouth, getting a beer here or there. And he's in the top group on the final day. And, you know, and that's just, it's amazing to see that, yeah, you can be damn near a professional or just a self-taught guy and play the game. Here, I got another question from off my case IH. Greg, are you going to play? Okay, here we go. Now it's big. The old course in St. Andrews. It's a great course in place.
Oh, great question. We have one day in our 8 days we've left open. They have what they call a lottery system.
Okay.
There's basically different ways you can attack a trip to Ireland or Scotland to golf. And we're working with a tour guide that has access to tee times on some of the top courses we want to play. So with St. Andrews, you can take one of the tour options that guarantees your access to that day. And then it sort of limits some of the other, and this trip, particular trip, the three guys I'm going with, three buddies of mine, we kind of decided let's leave one day open and we'll do the lottery.
Okay.
If one of us gets lucky and plays St. Andrews, the other three, we'll just go watch.
Yeah.
But if we don't hit the lottery, then we'll just probably spend the day walking around St. Andrews and kind of soaking up the vibe, because that is the literal home of golf.
Yeah.
So hallowed ground for sure.
Yeah, no, it'll be an awesome trip. And yeah, I think we really should maybe front run your big European Scotland adventure with the farm athletes.
Peter,
we'll come up with something cool. We've got a lot of interesting developments there as well. Yeah, Scott.
I got one question for
Greg
here. So, Greg, you mentioned a couple times that being a good husband and being a good father was really important to you. What do you mean by that? What are your metrics?
Well, my metrics for that were my eyes, what I saw growing up as a kid. I was, you know, we don't have a choice who our parents are. And I realized when I was young, I was fortunate and been thankful to have a mom and dad who were focused on us kids. I have one sister and two younger brothers, so there are four of us. And we all grew up in a loving home where our parents were interested in us, supported us, doing their thing. My dad's building a business. But we sat down at the dinner table. I think this resonates across farm country. It's the dinner table we sit at. I mean, the six of us, that when we all think about growing up, that's what we think about, is just nothing big in particular, but just it was the care. Mm-hmm. So when I got married, I was 23 years old, just a year out of college. My wife, Jackie from Rochester, she's a teacher. So we moved to Rochester. And we had started a family young. We were 25 years old. And I had my little machinery Pete business was so small. I mean, it was shockingly small. I had two part-time jobs. So I'm trying to scramble to put, you know, food on the table. My wife had a good job with benefits. But actually, in those days, I watched our two girls half days. So they didn't go to daycare. They were just with me.
Nice.
And part of that was just to save money because daycare was very expensive. But even being a young, stupid 25, 26, 27-year-old, I knew that if the girls and I were together, that as they grew the rest of their lives, they would know me and I would know them. And nothing against daycare is awesome, fantastic, whatever, but we can control what we can.
Yeah.
And again, having parents that were loving and supportive, again, my brothers and I wanted to be like our dad on the business front, on the golf course. We wanted to be a good golfer like dad, but also treat your competitors like dad did. I mean, it was kind of interesting. Our dad, again, he's 88 now. His best friend growing up in town was the international dealer. Mm. And that's from a John, you know, so I was 12 years old going, wow, that's, even I'm a young, stupid kid. That's kind of unusual. So again, that comes to your question, Scott, just wanting to be like your dad.
Yeah.
It was my dad's advice that got me into this business in the first place. Hmm. Because when my wife, Jack, and I got married, you know, like you said at the top, Zach, I'm truly a numbers guy. I was an accounting major at my little Gustavus Adolphus College while I played golf.
Okay.
And I wasn't a very good accountant. Mm-hmm. I was more worried about golfing back then. But when we got married and moved to Rochester, Jackie got a teaching job and I was looking for work.
Okay.
for about 1 month. And that was when my dad back in Benson called me up and he said, hey, why don't you come home? I got to show you something. Yeah. And that was the auction price book that a banker 30 miles down the road had started. And so the point being, listen to your parents.
Yeah.
They know you and they know things. They've been through things. So when I talk to young farm groups, you know, when it comes to, hey, Machinery Pete, what advice do you have? It ain't very complicated. On one front, it's like, listen to your parents and your grandparents.
Okay.
And don't just passively listen to them, engage them, because they come from a different generation.
Yeah.
Where you didn't just run around blabbing your mouth saying how things are.
Yeah.
They kept it in here. That's how they were taught.
Right.
Right or wrong. So one of the things when I would blog over the years on Thanksgiving, right, the week before Thanksgiving, I'd always tell young farmers, take these things we all carry around now and get your grandpa talking.
Yeah.
About, doesn't matter about what. Grandpa, what was it like when you started golfing or started farming? What was your favorite tractor? Because now that's data, that's video data that has the voice of your grandfather or your grandmother or your uncle that, again, math is math. They won't be with us always. But if you record them talking about something that's inside of them, and when you talk to a golfer about golf, you sound like I do here. It's just, you ask me these questions, you've cut open a vein in me that's important to me.
You're right, right.
And when you talk to farmers, you go around the country and you'll say, what's your favorite tractor?
Yeah.
And then say, well, why is that your favorite tractor? Almost inevitably, it goes to my dad or my grandpa, my brother, my uncle, my grandma. And those family pieces are important to us. So I think, again, you know, we grew up going to church every Sunday. And not that you grasp everything that's said every sermon, but I mean, there's truths there.
Yeah.
And there's a roadmap, and trying to be the best husband or father you can was part of the roadmap I was given and what we wanted to try and pass on to our two daughters. And I tell people now, we have a grandson that's two and we have two grandchildren on the way this spring. I can't decide what's more fun, hanging out with my two-year-old grandson or watching my daughter be a mom.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it's incredible. Six and one. Yeah. It's like six, like the kids say these days, 6-7. I mean, it's both awesome. So, but that's just life.
And, yeah. It's just, it's a whole different complex, and just even process it all sometimes. It's just, it's a little bit much. I don't know. I think there's so much potential for so many people. And I think the new rule of Christmas or Thanksgiving should be no cell phones in the house, you know, or put them in a lockbox if you're going to some party, because there's just so many missed interactions anymore with this younger generation. And they're around these elders that really have some awesome things to say, but you know, it's just scroll and brain rot, you know, right in their hands. And I think there's a lot of that that's just shaping what we're doing. And that's the cool thing about you and your brand. It is data driven. So there's a way that you can try to find these metrics, you know, look within the numbers to find a way to reach out and really have something compelling that means a little bit more to the average. But I don't know, it's just a lot to figure out. And I think what I need to do is I need to get my putting green in the Tractor Tuesday headquarters. I've got one during the whole COVID thing when that went down. I can't remember the brand, but I got a good 15-foot long putting green. And the only, that's the first step.
Putting is, putting is, my little town in Benson. So again, our house was right off the golf course. So we didn't have a range and we didn't have any teachers. So what I did as a kid is, and I was, you know, I was kind of I was very shy. So I was just into my own little world, but I spent so much time on the putting green and chipping. That's what I practice.
Okay.
And if you talk about competitive golf, playing tournament golf, the whole trick, it's not hitting, learning how to hit a 300-yard drive. That ain't it. The whole trick is when your ball gets up around the green.
Yeah.
You have to just chip it right by the hole and make it like every time.
Yeah.
That's how you get good at golf. It's not the other stuff. If you hit a bad chip and then three putt, you just turned a four into a six.
Yeah.
And the math part about golf is that it's simple. I gotta make a four. I have to make a four here. I can't make a six. And so Yeah, I think if you had a little putting green in your office, Zach, again, all you need is a little time, and then just give yourself a little grace and patience, and
I'll take a six all day. I mean, you talk about a double bogey golf round to me. If I could break 110, I think it'd be, most guys are trying to get sub 88 or sub 100. They've got this number that they're trying to. I just want to break through 100. I mean, honestly, if I can break through 110, I'm in business.
I'll give you the math machinery Pete grew up with on the golf course.
okay.
So there's par, basically play 18 hole course. Most courses are for 9 holes or par 36, par 72 for 18. So when you're little, you can't hit it far enough to make a par. But our dad taught us double bogey is your par. So 54 was our par, like when I was 7. So I'd go out and play, and I shot 58 today. I was 4 over. But as you get, the more you play, and of course, the bigger we got, stronger that fifth, and then you played bogey was your par. So now 45 is your par. And then you got closer, maybe 40 is your par, then 36. So again, that's all about expectation and data. And so if you started, Zach, it's like, hey, if you're making sixes, that's awesome. What you would find is that you would turn those sixes into fives pretty fast. And then your fives, you'd start turning those into a few fours. And again, your scores would just evaporate.
The good thing is somehow I just don't embarrass myself out there. It's like, yeah, I'm with these guys that are like a plus one handicap, and I'm not slowing anybody down. So somehow the golf gods are on my side. I'm
As long
not
as you
sure.
play quickly, that's all that matters. If you play slow, then if you shoot 68 and play slow, nobody wants to play with you.
Right.
If
Yeah.
you
And I think.
shoot 98 but play fast, it's like, hey, let's go play.
Yeah, and that's been my only advantage for my horrible golf game. And I don't know, I'd like to know the truth about Scott. He's such a modest guy talking about, oh, how many balls I lose. Yeah, and then probably shooting like a 5 or 6 handicap is what I'm guessing. Maybe a 12. Scott, what do you have it boiled down? How long have you actually been golfing?
I don't even know how to calculate the handicap.
Oh yeah, here we go. Yeah, I see guys like this sandbagging
But
all
that's good. You're playing. That's the thing, Scott. You don't have to get tied up in handicaps. Just go play with your friends, play with new people, enjoy being outside, get some exercise, hit a few good shots, and come back and do it again.
Hey, real quick, guys, we've got another question, kind of unrelated, but if you want to pop this up on the screen here, we got, sorry to get off the golf topic, but does Greg foresee 26 being a buyer's market, a seller's market, or a mixed bag?
Well,
Assuming
26.
machinery, I'm guessing, but.
Yes, 26, I think, is going to be a continuation of what we saw play out in 25, which was frankly something that I've never seen in my 36 and a half years tracking this stuff every day.
Yeah.
There's been ups and downs, there always will be. And every time in the past that I would see auction pricing significantly, noticeably rise, that always correlated to good conditions for new equipment sales.
Yeah.
And right now, that is not the case. We're seeing auction prices going up, and you look at the AEM numbers on new equipment sales, tractors, combine, it ain't happening.
Yeah.
So what's been happening? It's been kind of fascinating, but I think the price of new has got so high, coming off of those increases we saw coming out of the pandemic in 21, 2, 3. I used to figure about a 4% annual increase in the price of new equipment. And I
Yeah.
mean, 4% now would be like laughable, right? I
Yeah,
mean, it was
right.
25,
Right.
30% more. And those prices, they got up that high and they haven't come down.
Yeah.
And they won't come down because what have manufacturers done? They've closed plants and laid people off.
Right.
Yes.
So they're protecting the price point, which shareholders like, which whatever, corporate America. It used to be corporate America was like a three-legged stool where you were concerned with the shareholder, yes, very important, but also your customer and your employees. That's not so much the case these days, unfortunately. Not to be a grouchy old gray-haired guy, but again, I think what's happened is the farmers have had to stretch the life of their used equipment.
Yeah.
And if you're not buying new, then what you're doing is you're scouring the playing field looking for the nicest condition used. And
Yeah.
that's why we saw it started the third week of 25. We started to see auction prices solidify. They dropped like a rock in 24 because
Yes.
dealers were trying to get ahead of it and they were smashing record levels of 0, 1, 2, 3 year old stuff to auction to get rid of it because they were paying 8% interest sitting on their lot.
Right.
But again, 25 auction prices solidified. And the other interesting piece, curious to get your guys' take, but I'm starting to hear and feel a lot of farmers collectively sort of, as this stretched out period of nonprofits has been around, like, you know, we got pretty heavy equipment wise. We had a lot of equipment on the farm. How much equipment did my dad have when he was my age?
Yeah.
He didn't have this much.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of that, right or wrong, over the last, since 2002, since the Bush tax cuts, has been for tax purposes.
Yeah.
You know, nobody likes to pay taxes. Farmers get clobbered every angle. But does that make it right? You know, because our dad, it would scream every November and December, the auction prices would go straight up. And that was because farmers looking for a last minute deduction. Now, I've got a video I got to post from my accountant who passed away last year. He was the greatest guy. Harlan Bisbee was his name, Stacyville, Iowa. Harlan, when I would go down for my annual tax visit, and I don't farm, but we would talk about, he would always say, "Hey, Greg, what's happening with used values?" And I would say, "Well, you know, they went up November, December." And Harlan would kind of half smile. And we talked about it before he passed. I recorded a video. I'm going to post it. But his contention was pretty simple. He was like, you know, it's a good thing to pay taxes because it means you're making money.
Yeah.
If some of these actions, if they're solely on the equipment front done to minimize taxes, it's sort of like you're flipping a boomerang out there. Now, boomerangs, they go out that way, but they kind of come around back this way.
Yeah.
And so you just want to have all that well thought out. And right now, I just think farmers are kind of going, boy, you know, we had a lot of equipment. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be fascinating to me whenever corn and beans do finally go up at some point, which nobody is predicting will be soon. But to me, the fascinating part will be, will that jar loose the current farmer attitude of like, you know what, this new stuff is pretty high.
Yeah.
And maybe I don't need as much of it. And it's really, it's again, going back to growing up and going to church every Sunday, but money in and of itself is kind of the root of a lot of different decisions, good or bad. And, you know, and strictly from a business standpoint, whether it's your farm operation or building a machinery peep business or a Tractor Tuesday, Scott, your business, I mean, you just want to have a plan and make good decisions. And then use opportunities come along and take advantage of them, but you know, don't necessarily blow with the wind every which way the wind's blowing. And so I'll just be fascinated to see, but I think 2026, it's going to get interesting because the supply of used is starting to shrink.
Yeah.
Because there hasn't been any new sold the past few years outside of livestock stuff. So if you go forward another 1 or 2 years, in the past, in your farming career, what your dad or grandpa said was that every downturn, you are always in the driver's seat. Well, dealers always have too much use sitting on their lot. You can get a deal.
Yeah.
In 2024, we saw 150% increase in dealers auctioning off 0 to 3 year old equipment.
Yeah.
So they just got ahead of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that bubble ain't there anymore.
Right.
So I think that's the scary piece for me. I think whenever corn and beans do go up again, what we're going to be looking at is a replay of 2021 when there was money and farmers like, oh, I need a new planter. So you go to your dealer and they're like, well, we got an allotment. We got 8. If you want one, you got to let me know by 10 o'clock this morning. Otherwise, it's going to the next guy.
Yeah.
And the whole manufacturing process has moved to the you buy it, and then we'll build it model, which is efficient.
Right.
But if you're on the buying side, you got to be careful. Your eyes got to be wide open to this, or you'll get run over by a freight train.
Well, I didn't know you back in 21 the way I do now. But to me, the auctions drove the used values because it really was. I mean, you're going to pay a premium if you could actually get something. And I'm excited for those times again for people that are heavy on the machinery. But I think an interesting thing that you see it in other markets would just be like a farmer sentiment, or, you know, where are their heads at right now? And I'll tell you from my experience, I probably talk to a half a dozen farmers every day from different markets, different states. This is the most negative I've ever seen agriculture. Mm-hmm. And it probably would be similar from being, you know, watching what happened in the late 90s with our family, with, you know, raising and basically being in the hog game one way or the other. It seems very similar. You know, they first kind of broke the poultry guys. You know, they tried to break the hog guys. Are they breaking the row crop guys? I don't know. And with the replacement cost for livestock, it's such a delicate dance. And I think more farmers are just, they have fallen out of love with farming than I've ever heard. Me, I'll tell you, the drought of 23 about killed me off. So just, I already kind of had these negative thoughts already about what we're doing. And, you know, and that's sad because, you know, you should be able to at least raise a family. You know, you've got $10 million worth of farm, $1 million worth of heavy machinery, and you're literally losing $100 an acre. And it's just, it's easy to do. And I think that's what's unfortunate. We're going through a shift right now, and it's obviously affecting these values. There's more guys that are willing to admit, well, maybe my banker's been right the past decade. I really can't afford to own a combine anymore. And I think we're going to see more consolidation of the small operators. They may not give up the acres, but I think as far as sharing machinery, and it's probably right on time for what the big manufacturers are hoping to do with these subscription models moving forward. But
I agree, Zach. It's if I had a different hoodie on, my Purdue hoodie, which our youngest daughter graduated there 10 years ago, they do have that ag barometer index.
Oh, they do.
Very good farmer sentiment.
Cool. Yeah.
But it's been interesting from my seat, you know, because I go out to auctions and I hear exactly what you just said, Zach.
Yeah.
It's like record level of negativity, which, and that's very well deserved that farmers would feel that way.
Yeah.
The interesting part, though, is separating the what you say versus what I call checkbook reality. Like, okay, this asset's up for sale today on Tractor Tuesday. What did it sell for? And that's the piece where, you know, strictly from monitoring the data, it started to go like this. And then like a little bit like this in November, December, despite the negativity. So that's, again, something that I haven't seen in 36 years, which I think if you pull back, I think we just painted a picture of the definition of a K-shaped economy right there.
Yeah.
So if you're on the right side of that K going up, basically I just turned 60, like you, thank you for noticing, but most farmers are my age are up. And if you've weathered through the storms of the 80s, 90s, I mean, there's still some really strong balance sheets out there. Mm-hmm. That's probably, I think, why we're seeing land values. I mean, have they cratered?
No. And it's what we're going through right now is just, do you buy a farm and hope you get a 2% return while everybody else is playing these markets and 7-8% is pretty common. Here's a good question here from Loop Machinery. What are your thoughts on the government stimulus that's expected in February? I'll tell you mine, you know, about this current negative atmosphere. I think it never could have been big enough, you know, and that's the reality for me here in Nebraska. $43 or whatever it is an acre for corn, it doesn't even pay the property taxes. So, you know, when you lose a few hundred grand, as most producers did this year, I mean, it's, I wouldn't even call it a Band-Aid. But I do think for the larger producers that, you know, you can go off of their buying history, I think it's going to give us a little bit of an advantage at Tractor Tuesday.
The payment limitations, Zach, are going to cock block all that. You know?
Oh, okay.
Like I have, you know, we farm 8,000 acres. And under my social security number, so I'll get 150 grand and it's like,
oh wow,
it doesn't even pay the fuel bill, you know, half the fuel bill. It's just, yeah, the payment limitations are just going to come in and erase any sort of, you know.
I had no idea. I'm just kind of a read the headlines at Tractor Report type of guy. I don't have time to get in the weeds and block 500 pop-ups.
See, I've been asked, the Wall Street crowd hits me with that question really hard.
Yeah.
Oh, machine repeat. Well, is this stimulus gonna goose a new sales of equipment? Mm. And I think the answer is no. I don't. It's just to what you were saying, Zach, a little bit like just helping, you know, whether it's not even a Band-Aid, whatever. But I don't see it in any way, shape, or form as like as maybe other times in the past where you could expect it to goose new equipment sales and used values.
Right.
I think this time is just different. So,
That's the problem. There is no predictability here. We're living it. The numbers are what they are. And that's the cool thing about the Machine Repeat brand and what you continue to harvest and present to everybody in the audience. I wish, you know, things were a little bit more positive, you know, but I guess that's the nature of farming. And we're just in one of those seasons right now. So,
well, for someone who's, again, struggled with his golf game for literally 20 years, you know, and I love farmers, I've been working with them for 36 plus years. We have to have faith.
Yeah.
And that's why every day when we get up, you know, every day is a gift and a blessing.
Yeah.
And even through these hard, difficult, soul crushing, difficult times, it's, you know, and then that gets back to Scott, what you were saying, you know, there's business and then there's family and life and community. And we do the best we can. That's what I love about farmers. They every year, it's faith forward with eyes open.
Yeah.
And making the best business decisions you can. And yeah, we can just hope the 26 and forward beyond will create some better conditions in ag country and, you know, to benefit everyone in ag.
Well, and like both sides of that K, you know, you're exactly right. Yeah, the negativity's there, but if you're not an optimist, you're probably not farming anymore, you know, and it's just, oh, you know, look at all this gambling and everything going on. Well, a lot of farmers don't gamble on sports because we gamble at life.
Right.
And that's really all we're doing here. We're basically professional gamblers that have found a way to the banker to take our phone call somehow.
You know, one more data point that does jive with what you were saying earlier, Zach, about, you know, into this negativity. One of the things I track is the raw volume of auctions.
Yeah.
So now the latest data I have was through October.
Mm.
And in 2025, the number of machinery auctions was up 15%. And I haven't tabulated through the end of the year yet. I'm guessing it's going to be pushing, if not 220, really close. And in 25, this was driven by farmers stopping the equity drain, slash the pressure. If you're a younger farmer, the lending pressure, you know, and that's unfortunate. But again, that makes it all the more unusual that in the past, with an increase in number of auctions, that's always correlated to pricing falling,
right?
But not this time.
Yeah.
So I think it's all tied back to that price of new equipment that I think a lot of people feel that it just got too high.
Yeah.
And however we got there, it's just too high.
Yeah.
And now it's creating some ripples that we haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be fascinating to see kind of where it goes from here.
Well, and you look back even in my little lifetime, you know, my dad planted a heck of a lot of $7 corn with a 7,300 planter, you know? And so when you think about some of this technology, you know, does it pay to push for 300 bushel or should you just settle for 220 and be cost effective? And you're seeing that, you know, obviously pre-def, it's almost overspoken, but it's just, those are some of the things that are driving some of these records is, you know, these model years that are before emissions. And the strength there is just, it's almost staggering. It's almost hard to even process.
I've described that,
You
know, Machine Repeat writing about pre-def prices is kind of a meme at this point, but.
Yeah, I know, it just never ends.
But I would say to me, the way I describe it is the whole pre-def thing is a neon sign.
Yeah.
But someone in control of that sign is cranking up the brightness on all this neon, whether it's green, red, blue, or orange or whatever. And it's just becoming more brighter and more prominent. So, yes, I was real interested when the calendar flipped to 26, you know, because, again, November and December, we saw this big push. And it's like, okay, let's take out the year-end guys. Well, my good friends Kiko Auctioneers had a sale yesterday in Salem, Ohio with a 99 model 7810 two-wheel drive John Deere, 5,007 hours, one owner. Beautiful. So what's it bring? Hard cash. Now, this, again, is when this record level of negativity brought $75,000.
Wow.
And if you wade into our Machine Repeat data, you're going to find that's the second highest auction price ever on a 7810 two-wheel drive with over 5,000 hours.
Yeah.
The only one higher was last April.
Yeah.
So that tells you what people, again, checkbook reality. They want nice condition, older stuff that doesn't cost this. Mm-hmm. So you got five guys that want that 27-year-old 7810. We saw Magnum 7120 last Wednesday in Centerville, Indiana, go for $60K with 4,902 hours.
Wow.
Second highest one ever with two-wheel drive over 4,000 hours. So, again, checkbook reality. It is what it is.
Well, and you can buy a shiny rock of silver for $80 an ounce right now. You know, and so things are just – the values are just so much different. There's so much – I it's just hard to even process. Scott, what are your thoughts going into 26? And Greg, if you don't know, New Age Ag Supply, they've got a ton of awesome equipment. It's just, it's almost, it's hard to even believe, you know, the inventory you've got, Scott, but what are your thoughts now we're in the new year?
I don't know. I try not to make a prediction. It's always wrong.
Yeah.
I don't know. Commodity prices have to come up for things to soften. Or same things to firm up, you know, for pricing and stuff like that. The dealers aren't giving deals out. They're dropping their price, but they're still way behind the eight ball on true values. Like what Greg was saying, you know, true. Mm-hmm. The value is the number that it's selling for at auction or whatever. Farmers are buying at auctions. They're kind of stabbing. They've been tired of getting stabbed by their dealer and they're going to auctions. There's nice equipment on auctions. There's less volume there was this year than last year. So I think that's part of the reason, supply and demand, that you see the higher values. Because last year was, I had an auction last year. And there was so much volume. It was crazy. I mean, you could buy 10X9 combines in the month of December on auction. Mm-hmm. This year, maybe two. I don't know. But
it's going to be interesting. I think we're excited to see. I guess, thankfully, so far, what we've got slated, I keep looking over at my other screens here, but we've got probably the nicest 4440 you've ever seen, legacy inspection. We've got a two-wheel drive 7630. You know, it's just all within the theme here of what some of these
people want.
Well, and that's really where we're at. And I'm looking forward. We do have a couple dealership inventory reductions in February that I think – it's the right type of equipment. And these dealerships know what they're doing. It's a lot of off-brand trade-in, you know, things that don't necessarily fit in with their service area, that they're looking to get that natural coverage, you know, nationwide at least. And that's what folks are looking for. And there's so many great tools out there. There's so much great data. I guess we'll see how it all plays out and just hope for the best for the farmers. I mean, machinery sales, you know, aside here, you know, we're dealing with great people. I think a lot of what you could say on today's conversation is just the power of conversation and being able to have these types of experiences, live your life, do things and enjoy it a little bit, because, you know, when it's all said and done, does any of this really matter? You know, and it's just, and it's fun that we can focus and have that all there, but at Tractor Tuesday, we're just trying to do the right thing for the people we care about the most. And those are the farmers and the folks working on our equipment. And I think that's really the perspective. And we were just hoping things would, you know, get into the new year, maybe a few new trade deals would arise and things would be a little bit more optimistic for farmers. But here we are again. And it's like, gosh, March 1st is creeping up quick. And I know a lot of the local banking groups here, they're a little bit leery. You know, our guy's going to get renewed, you know, and I think what we're going to see is more March auctions than we've ever seen that should have been auctioned in February. Because I think, as you know, myself as a farmer, I'm a procrastinator too. And if my banker says, hey, you got to clean up your balance sheet, yeah, well, I'm going to get it sold on retail. Well, you're probably not. And then when that doesn't happen, then, well, gosh, I guess the banker was right. We're going to go to auction. So hopefully they look for that low cost solution. Yeah, they play with Tractor Tuesday or not. We've got a lot of great ones out there. Popping it up one more time before we get a wrap, but February 17th is shaping up. It's going to be a fun date. I think there'll be a lot of cool inventory. There'll be three baby Bosleys here in Hastings at that point. So we'll see. But, you know, back to one more thing, I'm not mad at my wife's golf. I'm actually really excited about it. I think it's a fun thing and I congratulate, but yeah, instead of, you know, me going to men's golf league, she goes to women's. You know, that's the only difference. And there's no hard feelings there. I don't know how I'm going to handle three babies though at the house. Our oldest is three, you know, and I guess I'll only be changing one diaper. We've got the other two potty trained, thankfully.
So. I'll just tell you, Zach, it's what if interacting at auctions all these years, I ask, you know, you get visiting with people, how many kids you have. And when I find folks like yourself that have a number of little ones, I know, I remember what those days were like. But I will also see, I got all this gray hair.
Yeah.
Looking backwards at this way, I'm just gonna tell you, as crazy as that gets, brother, just as tired as you might be, that's the best stuff. So that day is just finding that time to just take that breath. And yeah, I suppose the correlation there to farming in these tough times. It's like if you're doing what you love, that's just a gift.
Yeah.
And so finding it within ourselves to find a way to feel thankful about those challenges. But you are being a very supportive husband by supporting your wife.
Oh, it's not even, I've had it so easy, Greg. It's really no big, our kids sleep all night. You know, my wife gets them potty trained by about 18 months old. I mean, we run in a machine fashion at our little household. So really it's no big deal. I hear so many horror stories. I'm probably due for one. And a lot of other parents like to tell us that, oh, wait till the next one. Well, we're two for two. It's been pretty easy, I guess, at least for me. So, but, well, hey, Scott, to wrap this thing all up. Yeah. Do you have any other questions here while we're sitting with Greg, or what are your thoughts on today's show?
Yeah. I thought Greg had a lot of insight and wisdom that he picked up from golf, you know, not carrying your mistakes into the next round or the next hole. Like there's a lot of really great, great wisdom that Greg had got from golf and carried into his professional career. So, really impressed, Greg. That was your humble guy. Appreciate having you on here.
Guys, big fan of what you're doing. And I've never been interviewed about my golfing part of my past. So it makes me smile that you asked, Zach. So thank you for that.
If I could throw in
mm-hmm. one little thing mm-hmm. on the machinery side to wrap
yeah,
up.
Yeah, please.
I do think there is an opportunity in 26, folks, and if you look at that 3 to 7 year old used equipment, tractors, combines, whatever, there's a little bit more of that stuff mm-hmm. because it gets back to when a lot of that was sold when times were good. What I'm seeing happen is the used inventory is crunching down.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're able, you know, call your local dealer or hit an auction like Zach's coming up and get yourself a really good low-hour 3, 4, 5, 6 year old tractor, combine, sprayer, whatever. One of the truths that I found from our data for 36 years now is once you get to be 10 years old with a sharp low hour item,
mm-hmm.
that's gold, because then you have what everybody wants. Whether you want to trade that in, sell it private, keep running it, you're in good shape. So the real value for me that I see it is being an aggressive buyer in that 3 to 7 year old range.
Okay.
And so not to pump for our dealer partners or our auction partners having sales, but if this continues for another half year, year, 2 year like this, I think we're going to run into 21 where everything sold high.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to buy new, it was a lottery. So that's looming down the road. It's just a question of when. So,
yeah.
Well, I think that could be directed at Steve Bosley. And I think Zach ought to have an S7 combine here or something, but yeah.
She repeat approved. Yes.
Yeah, please. Yeah. The 9570 is getting a little old, so we got to figure out the next move. But well, hey, Greg, let everybody know where they can find you.
Yeah. Just hit our website, folks, machinerypete.com. Just a huge thank you for all your support all these years helping me along. I didn't train for any of this, but it's been so much fun. Our TV show airs on weekends on like 65 stations around the country. And now that I think of it, actually, if we pull this golf thing together, we should bring our cameras and do a special episode of the TV show about farmer golf. Maybe in Hastings, Nebraska should be the kickoff. And then find whether it's your NIL, great cause you have there, tractor rescue, whatever. But a golf episode of Machinery Pete TV might be kind of fun.
I think we could maybe even get, you know, somebody like Larry the Cable Guy interested. We've got a few other interesting folks that love the game of golf that are in this neck of the woods that might support a good cause. And you know, just like everything else, if it's very cliche, but if you build it, I really think they'd come. I think we could get a lot of really fun people. So, yeah, start looking at that calendar, Greg, and let me know in June. I think that's kind of the target. If we could just get past Memorial weekend, we could maybe get something on our radar here.
Well, we'll compare notes and see what we can put together, brother.
Awesome. Hey, well, Greg, it was an honor to have you on again today. And like I said, everybody like, share, subscribe, do what you got to do. Go to TractorTuesday.com. We're the no-cost solution for all things that you need. You'll find it at Tractor Tuesday. For Scott Anderson, I'm Zach Bosley. Greg, Machine Repeat Peterson, thanks again, sir. I appreciate your time. And signing off, we'll catch you next time, maybe on a Tuesday.
Till the soil only for a season, then the rains have come. All my fields way before my eyes, golden under sun.
Oh shoot, we lost her.